Subterranean SCPs. From Journey to the Center of the Earth to Ted the Caver, the world underneath our feet has always contained an air of mystery and the unknown. Winding tunnels and vast caves deeper and deeper into the earth can conceal all manner of things fantastical and horrific, from mole men to dark deities. It's no surprise at all, then, that subterranean SCPs comprise a relatively big section of the SCP Wiki, pertaining to nearly 300 articles in various degrees. There isn't really much that connects them together other than all taking place underground, but at least it's an opportunity to check out an array of different anomalies. Let's take a look. Let's start with a classic, SCP-1351. A cave located within Mammoth Cave National Park in Kentucky. The main section of cave is approximately 30 kilometers long, and although no direct connections between the anomaly and Mammoth Cave have yet been discovered, the possibility remains. Like most caves in the area, 1351 appears to have been carved from Mississippian-aged limestone strata, capped by sandstone, which has resulted in relatively few flowstone deposits. 1351 is anomalous for three reasons. One being that it's accessible through a dome in the ceiling of an otherwise unremarkable section of cavern 125 meters underground, but the dome's height of 750 meters would require the cave to be well above surface level. In spite of the inconsistency, 1351 seems to be subterranean. I would hope so, otherwise it would be a pretty poor fit for this episode. Secondly, the interior of the cave only has a single surface and a single wall. Over the course of the cavern's several kilometers in length, the floor wraps around to become the ceiling, while one wall wraps around to become the other. In this, it resembles a Mobius strip. Local gravity orients towards the nearest floor, and a dark band in the rock wall shows the location of the boundary between the local gravitational fields. Lastly, temporal anomalies have been observed in relation to 1351, though no modern Foundation personnel are known to have experienced any such effects. The cavern from which the cave is accessible opened to the surface when a landslide in 1993 uncovered a natural entrance. It was most recently discovered in 1995 by National Park Service speleologists mapping the cavern to determine if it connected to the main cave system in the park. These scientists were subsequently seconded to the Foundation after a standard background check and non-disclosure agreement. Three expedition teams surveyed the interior of the cave between 1995 and 2002, determining it to be sufficiently safe for a permanent research presence. On April 23, 2009, a team of six men and two women under the command of Major Mortimer S. Cornelius III emerged from the cave. They were detained by Foundation security personnel, and interviews established that they were a team of explorers dispatched by the Foundation in August of 1925. From their perspective, they had only spent 18 hours within the cave. Their clothing and equipment was accurate for the time period, and they possessed apparently bona fide documents supporting their assertions. However, as there is no record of any of the members of the expedition, nor of the expedition itself, and since the cave wasn't known to have been discovered until 1995, they are being detained indefinitely. That's a pretty crummy day at work, I must say. On June 10th, 2011, Foundation researchers discovered the remains of four adult humans in a pit in the cave. These remains had been mummified and preserved by the calcium nitrate present in the cavern, with carbon dating indicating the remains to be in excess of 7,000 years old. One of the bodies had two broken legs, while another had a broken left arm. There was no obvious cause of death for any of the subjects. Three of them possessed Foundation-issued dog tags identifying them as doctors, while the fourth was missing her head and had no identification. The bodies were clothed in uniform, synthetic, spelunking coveralls and equipped with gear estimated to be roughly equivalent to the level of technology expected to exist by the mid-2030s. Among the gear was a damaged camcorder with predictably dead batteries. Efforts to power the camcorder and recover the information documented have been expunged from the record. So, yeah, pretty vague about what's going on here, other than it seems to be shifting Foundation researchers back and forward through time inside of it. What exactly killed those future researchers and ripped off one of their heads is a good question, though. You'd think the Foundation would stop sending researchers in at this point, but I suppose now they might have to prevent some sort of paradox. Next, we have SCP-2464, a temporal and spatial anomaly existing within the Morris Limestone Mine, located in Indiana. It's only accessible through the removal of a large stone slab that covers its only entrance, and other methods of attempting to access it have proven unsuccessful. Cutting into the space where it should be reveals only solid limestone. The interior of the space usually appears to be a large, open field of rolling hills that extends indefinitely in all directions. Situated roughly 50 meters in front of the entrance is a 1960s American farmhouse in a state of advanced disrepair. Analysis of plant matter within the space has revealed no unknown or foreign biological substances. The sun within the area is perpetually situated at dusk. Two anomalous entities and one anomalous machine are contained within the farmhouse, all located in the second floor master bedroom. SCP-2464-2 is a human female, aged at approximately 12 years old. She is roughly 1.4 meters in height, with brown hair that appears to have not been cut for several years. Her eye color cannot currently be determined. She's situated on the bed within the master bedroom, perpetually open-mouthed, but otherwise unmoving and unresponsive, likely due to the effects of 2464-3 and -4. She's held to the bed by shackles located on her wrists and ankles, although all are severely rusted. 2464-3 is her identical twin sister, suspended on the ceiling above her by a series of iron clasps around the knees, ankles, elbows, wrists, torso, and neck. She's similarly unresponsive, likely due to the effects of 2464-4. She's extremely emaciated and constantly secretes a viscous black liquid through her mouth, which falls into the open mouth of her sister. The source of this liquid is currently unknown. 2464-4 is a machine believed to be designed and constructed by the late Dr. Michael Banning, a Foundation researcher from 1934 to 1975. It is situated within the second floor master bedroom, against the north-facing wall, and consists of a main hub along with a number of copper tubes, which run up the wall and towards 2464-3. These tubes all enter her via copper access ports on her right side, just below the armpit. Additionally, a number of biological components have been discovered at various locations throughout the apparatus, although their purpose is currently unknown. The entirety of the machine is in a state of disrepair, and is the subject of an ongoing attempt to fully restore the entire mechanism. The apparent purpose of the machine is to extend the lifespan of 2464-3 by means of preventing her from aging. While this process appears to have been thus far effective, an apparent side effect is the degeneration of her cell tissues, resulting in a number of cancers appearing throughout her body. While the rate of expansion of these cancers has been kept to a minimum by the machine, due to its state of disrepair, current models predict that it will be unable to sustain its current processes for longer than another 10 years without repair, which will likely result in her expiration. The anomaly was initially discovered during routine limestone cutting by Morris Limestone personnel, who reported that they had broken through the limestone shelf into a clearing on the other side. After the nature of the anomaly was assessed, Foundation agents took over the mine and set up a provisional site. After a thorough examination of the farmhouse, it became clear that it was the home owned by Dr. Banning until it burned down in 1975. Upon entering the master bedroom, personnel found the machine in a state of considerable disrepair. It was noted within the original Discovery report that although the machine was experiencing several catastrophic malfunctions of critical components, it did not give any indication that it was not performing its job as designed. Throughout attempts to repair it, even when other considerable failures have occurred, it has shown little sign of stopping at all. It's currently believed that 2464-2 is a Class 4 reality-bending entity, and that the entirety of the anomaly, aside from her sister and the machine, is a result of that nature. Although she has not shown any evidence of active reality bending during her time within Foundation containment, the presence of the spatial anomaly, coupled with the information gathered from Dr. Banning's personal files, has led to the conclusion that the function of her sister was a means by which to hold her in an indefinite stasis, within which she would be unable to utilize her anomalous characteristics. Despite this, it seems as if she is capable of bending reality subconsciously, likely resulting in the creation of the anomalous space. It's also currently believed that were the machine to malfunction and her sister expire as a result, she would be released from her current stasis. Given the information gathered from Dr. Banning's logs about the severely deteriorated mental state of his daughter, it is well within the realm of possibility that this event could trigger an RK-class reality restructuring scenario by means of her out-of-control reality disruptions. Because of these factors, it's been proposed that the anomaly be upgraded from Euclid to Keter. During routine maintenance on the machine on June 15th, 2013, the maintenance team leader reported hearing sounds coming from the master bedroom before his team had reached it. Upon entering the room, they reported that the twin sister had her eyes open, a trait that had not been observed during containment. The order was given to perform the maintenance on the machine as instructed and continue to monitor the sister. The scheduled maintenance went without further complication. The team leader reported that her eyes would follow the team members, but she showed no other movement of any kind. The team departed the farmhouse with no complications, and she has not displayed this type of activity since. The upgrade from Euclid to Keter was approved. So, a guy that worked for the Foundation had two twin daughters, with one of them being a very powerful reality bender. He used his knowledge and resources from the Foundation to put her into indefinite stasis, sacrificing his other daughter to make it possible. This has gone on now for decades, but the machine that's sustaining the stasis is starting to fail, and the sister is starting to wake up. If the stasis fails, the reality bender is not going to be too pleased when she wakes up. I'm not quite sure why the guy that works for a massive organization that contains anomalies wouldn't have just gone to that organization to help contain his anomalous daughter, but what do I know? I realize that this one wasn't really subterranean in nature, but I wasn't sure when the hell else I would put it in. Moving on, we have SCP-1859, a rapidly developing ecosystem enclosed by a temporal anomaly located in a massive chamber several kilometers beneath the surface. It was initially believed to have been a natural nuclear fission reactor due to relatively high amounts of emitted radiation. It's currently unknown how it is able to remain stable despite its size, or why the chamber is cooler than the surrounding mantle, but it's hypothesized to be related to the temporal anomaly in some way. Initial observations of the anomaly noted unusually high levels of incredibly energetic ionizing radiation, with both wavelength and flux decreasing as one travels away from the center of the chamber. When researchers looked into the center, they observed it as appearing very hazy and distorted. It was soon discovered that both of these observations were related to the temporal anomaly. As one approaches the center, time is observed to pass at a different rate, such that an observer farther from the center sees external time pass more quickly than an observer closer in. The relationship between time and the distance from center is such that radiation that enters the anomaly is redshifted, so that when it is reflected from an object within, it is scattered in a manner consistent with a much lower frequency wave. Likewise, radiation produced in the center of the anomaly, no matter how low its energy, is blue-shifted to such an extent that the end result, when observed from outside, appears as high-energy ionizing radiation. Though the actual source is unknown, calculations indicate that at the center, the photons are consistent with the primary resonance frequency of electromagnetic radiation in the chamber itself. A lot of technical jargon there, but basically, the closer to the center you go, the faster time moves. This is causing normal background radiation in the chamber to become extremely lethal radiation near the center. The innermost green zone is a region in which flux and frequency of radiation are such that life can theoretically be sustained. The red zone is where the radiation is blue-shifted to potentially dangerous frequencies, and the flux is high enough that lethal exposure is guaranteed. Radiation in the outermost white zone, though more energetic, is sufficiently diffused that radiation poisoning can be treated, so long as exposure is limited. When initially discovered, the entirety of the chamber was sterile due to the effects of ionizing radiation. Samples from within the green zone confirmed a thick deposit of simple organic matter. Following the third expedition, from which a D-class did not return, a sudden decrease in oxygen levels within the chamber was observed before levels restabilized. The 6th through 8th expeditions found a coating of slime on the chamber floor, which increased in mass as time went on. This slime, along with other life seen in future observations, have been determined to have descended from the gut flora of the D-class, based on recovered samples. Drops in radiation flux were noted and determined to be related to the emergence of photosynthetic organisms, which use the resonant radiation of the chamber as an energy source. In addition, primitive animal-like life forms had been observed. Life finds a way. At some point, observations from a monitoring station saw signs of fauna native to the green zone performing actions inside the white zone. Despite the majority not surviving long after passing through the red zone, excursions of native fauna have since increased in frequency, leading to current special containment procedures. One expedition found evidence of primitive tools used within the green zone. The life form that produced the tool has not yet been directly encountered, but this suggests the potential of a sapient entity developing within the ecosystem. The next few expeditions have shown little change in the design of newfound tools, suggesting that the population producing these tools are remaining stagnant in their development. Another expedition, however, found that the primitive tools are attributed to a predatory plant. The stones are fashioned using a set procedure that is dictated purely by instinct. Despite this being a false alarm, they highly recommend that a guideline be put in place should a sapient life form evolve within the chamber. Yeah, I would say a Venus flytrap instinctively putting together a hammer is probably a cause for some concern. One doctor on the project questioned whether they are to treat these theoretical intelligent lifeforms as a new friend or as a potential threat. If they're a threat, wouldn't it be wiser to use any means to destroy the Green Zone ecosystem immediately, rather than sit idly by as the danger becomes more and more likely? Time is ticking while they think things over. We're then given a summary of the development of life inside of the anomaly. Basically, it was impossible for life to maintain any kind of foothold in the green zone prior to the Foundation's discovery of the anomaly. Airborne bacteria couldn't survive passing through the red zone, and organic material found in the outer regions of the white zone reproduced too slowly to survive extended exposure to the radiation near the center. The D-class that died traveled quickly through the red zone via a special vehicle the Foundation uses, which allowed a small number of bacteria living on and within his body to survive. This bacteria fed on his corpse until a few made the transition to the organic deposits. Their descendants then spread through the entirety of the green zone, managing to produce an extensive biofilm. How that biofilm developed the capacity for photosynthesis is still unknown, but the unusual physics within the anomaly require that all photosynthesis depends on the radiation produced in the center of the phenomenon. Therefore, the first flora proved to be ridges extending from the biofilm, each its own unique ecosystem that depended on the primary radiation frequencies found in that region. The most successful colonies ultimately spread through the biofilm, producing concentric rings centering around the radiation source. The competition between concentric colonies had two effects. The first was the development of independently autonomous fauna, the first of which were slow-moving extensions of an outer colony that would eat the ridges closer in and provide a gap through which radiation could pass. The ancestors of the current native fauna were likely a reproductive adaptation that caused the extensions to bud off and find a new area in which to settle, similar in function to a plasmodial slime mold. Since that initial adaptation, the fauna have developed into multiple complex forms that have few, if any, morphological similarities to their plant-like ancestors. Many have even lost their photosynthetic capability. The second effect was the current distribution of flora within the green zone. Some more technical jargon here, but basically the flora can't absorb every bit of radiation produced, instead transforming the lowest frequencies into chemical energy and re-emitting it as black body radiation. This becomes energetic enough that it can be absorbed by other plants growing farther out, similar to a step-down transformer. This ecology is believed to be what allows some native fauna to pass through the red zone relatively unharmed. Though some of these life forms have been seen to adapt via behavior, the scattering of photons from farther in still kills many of them. Lastly, we're given some notes from another doctor on the project, which read, "Many have wondered what it is like to walk through the green zone. Interviews from multiple expeditions have shed light, so to speak, on what one would experience. As you enter the wilderness within the green zone, you will notice a faint red light between the leaves of the plants. The plants themselves would be dark. Going deeper, you will see that faint glow remain unchanged, though the shapes of the leaves might be different. The red light is nothing more than Sisyphus's boulder, caused by the infrared radiation produced by the inner plants, blue-shifted into visibility. You will never find its source, no matter how far in you go. Turning around to leave, you will see nothing but darkness. Should you have a flashlight in hand and turn it on, you will see an impossibly sharp image. The light that you produce is blue-shifted as it travels, until it connects with the plants that live there. It is then reflected back to you with very high resolution. Sadly, the human eye is not equipped to resolve much of the detail that is there. What is interesting is that some of that light, because it's so energetic by the time that it reaches its destination, will pass through the plant and reflect off of layers that are still farther out. And so, hidden within the detail of one layer, will be a faint echo of others still farther out. Now point the flashlight back in. You will see what can perhaps be one of the saddest and inspiring sights you've ever witnessed. The wall of plants in front of you will visibly wilt from the visible radiation produced by your flashlight. Deeper in, you will see the red plants that had teased you earlier also wilt away, even more quickly than those directly next to you. Several layers will eventually be exposed, each whiter than the last. When you get to a shade about the same as what you see coming from the flashlight, the plants there will begin to grow on top of each other, attempting to absorb every last bit of light that you've produced. For a short time, you will have become a bringer of new life within the green zone. When you finally turn your flashlight off, though, be aware that you will have also taken the source of that life away forever. All of these things have made me and several other researchers envy the D-class personnel who actually see this firsthand. We don't envy them enough to allow ourselves to die of radiation sickness just for the experience, but still enough to sigh wistfully at what could have been. So yeah, certainly an egghead's dream here, an area where time moves fast enough to witness the birth of life and evolution firsthand. That being said, I don't see how the Foundation could afford to not try and collapse this whole thing in before a tribe of angry ferns marches out with assault rifles. Then again, I'd kind of like to see that. Next, we have SCP-7900, a monastery founded in 1208 CE named Notre Dame de la Mer. It lies 7 kilometers off the coast of Normandy, France, on a rocky islet surrounded by deep waters. It was originally constructed as a military garrison for the French army in the first 100 Years' War due to its strategic location, but was soon after converted to a Catholic institution. Due to its isolation from the mainland, it quickly gained a reputation as a place of spiritual healing and introspection. Due to the difficulty in traveling to it, it was only populated by a small settlement of devotees who lived permanently on the islet. Public awareness of the monastery slowly declined over time due to its remoteness and the self-imposed solitude of its populace. At some point, contact between the residents and the European continent was cut off completely, and the practiced religion on the islet shifted significantly from Catholicism. It eventually became little more than a myth by the 1300s, and has since been expunged completely from public records after its discovery by the Foundation in the late 19th century. At an unknown time, a Romanesque cathedral was built, and over the next 100 years, various additions were made to the original structure, including a bell tower, living quarters, and crypt. These additions were aesthetically unique, though limited in scope due to the islet's scarce resources. Its designs sharply contrast mainland cathedrals through their incorporation of fluid shapes, vast reductions of natural light, and an emphasis on the color blue. Recovered tapestries, murals, and stained glass designs place a heavy thematic emphasis on the serenity associated with drowning. A vast tympanum above the entrance to the main cathedral depicts the ritualistic mass drowning of upwards of 50 individuals. Inside, murals and stained glass patterns portray the death, purification, and eventual transmutation of the soul after drowning, frequently paired with depictions of sea life, such as cetaceans and semi-aquatic human hybrids. A tapestry recovered in the crypt portrays a group of missionaries uncovering a vast flooded cave containing a preserved whale carcass. Various metal weights, assumed to have been used to assist in drowning, were recovered within 7900's living quarters. Affixed to the wall behind the altar of the cathedral was a whale skull of an unidentified species, visually similar to that of the gray whale. The lower mandibles were recovered in the crypt, bearing hundreds of names and dates carved onto their surfaces, some as recent as the 1850s. Amalgamized fossilized remains surround the islet, suggesting the presence of unprecedented numbers of sea life throughout the monastery's history. Currently, the islet is largely devoid of life. At the time of discovery, it was abandoned, but has since become a vital asset to Foundation cultural studies in the region, helping to chronicle a rich, yet grim period in French history. Beneath the monastery lies an expansive network of tunnels constructed at an unknown date. The network was discovered during archaeological digs around the base of the islet, and although they have yet to be fully explored, survey teams have mapped over 150 kilometers to date. Estimates place the total size of the network between 600 and 1,000 kilometers. Much of the network appears to be naturally occurring, but significant portions have been reinforced with intricate and advanced architecture. Unlike the above-ground portions, building materials used in the tunnels are foreign to the islet, consisting mostly of rare white soapstone and whalebone. Man-made reinforcements continue intermittently some 400 meters underground, despite the infeasibility of such construction projects given the technology available at the time of the monastery's use. During preliminary explorations, it was discovered that the network possesses an anomalous effect that causes individuals to have a higher than average likelihood of becoming lost, even when using advanced navigation equipment. Rescued personnel consistently report becoming lost through non-anomalous means, such as equipment malfunction, disorientation, or unstable geologic activity, but repeated incidents suggest anomalous interference. This effect was noticed when Special Task Force Mammoth, a reconnaissance team specializing in subterranean exploration, failed to broadcast its all-clear signal for over 3 hours while underneath the monastery. The team was declared MIA 3 days after loss of contact, but was discovered shortly after by rescue patrols. During debriefing, members of the team described becoming disoriented after attempting to return to the surface the way they came. Following standard protocol, they began methodical lateral exploration until reaching a flooded cave, which continued down an indiscernible depth. While devising a plan for rescue, several members of the team reported hearing vocalizations similar to whale song emanating from the water. A closer investigation failed to reveal a source, but the team did recover a collection of metal weights similar to above-ground artifacts. The vocalizations were described as increasing in intensity, amplified by the cave walls, until the team was forced to retreat from the cavern. We're given an excerpt from the testimony of the Chief Demolition Specialist for Special Task Force Mammoth. It reads, "Me and Urchek are setting up the spikes for a radar sweep. The mission's gone to hell, so we're going to try to find a weakness in the rock for a controlled blast, which would either clear a path or at least alert you guys to our location. Tanner tells us to head down the slope a bit to widen the range of the image, since we only have so much time before the batteries die. We get in about 15 meters from the rest of the team, towards the water. Then I hear something. Sounded like a yelp. I look over at Urchek. He shrugs. I hear it again. Louder, but less sharp. The cave's echoing, so I can't pin down the direction of the source. We fan out, thinking it's a wild animal or maybe a person. Then Urchek screams, and I see him fall backward out of the corner of my eye. I rush over. He's pointing at the water, saying he saw something in it. A whale, he says, peeking up at him. I help him up, and we both scan for movement. Nothing. We hear the noise again. This time, it's unmistakably coming from the water. A long wail, followed by short clicks and pops. I see Urchek shaking. He's still green, so I'll cut him some slack. We see ripples in the water, and I tell Urchek to go and get Tanner. He runs off, tail between his legs. But I didn't. I wasn't scared, no. Why should I be? It only wanted to save my soul." Photographs of the cavern match descriptions of a divine grotto pictured in documents recovered from the monastery. 2 months after the incident, the demolition specialist was reported absent from his post at an unrelated anomaly. Several days later, a security detail stationed at the monastery noticed burn marks at the entrance of the subterranean network, appearing to form a trail leading into the system. Tanner and other members of Mammoth were requested to investigate, given their prior experience with the anomaly. We're given Tanner's testimony about the incident, which reads, "I've known Rick a long time. He was one of the founding 6 members of Mammoth, the only one to survive that gravity well at Mystery Spot. Saved my life more than once. He's tough, is what I'm saying. 20 years on this job, and I've never seen someone crumble to pieces like Rick did. See, he'd been acting weird for a while now. He'd take a little too long to answer questions. Sometimes he'd be completely unresponsive. Given his position in the team, I figured he could hurt someone or himself. We were working on a job in Brazil, so I assumed it was malaria or something. I had him stay at camp and told him to wait there until the doctors could fly in from Sao Paulo before handling any more of the dynamite. We were out maybe 12 hours. By the time we were back, he was gone. Just up and left. Took his stuff, but nothing else. Searched the area and came up with nothing. We wrote him off as another casualty of the profession. It's tough, but you get used to it here. We were writing up the report when you guys called. Said you'd found something at 7900 and that we were needed. We were there the next day. And before you ask, we followed the scorch marks. Sure, the thought of a trap crossed my mind, but I figured it was better than getting lost like last time. Plus, we were armed to the teeth and given provisional fireteam status. Not exactly sitting ducks. It took half an hour of winding tunnels and pearl-white bas reliefs to find the end of the trail, right at the mouth of the flooded cavern. I turn on my high-beam flashlight, and I see Rick sitting there at the edge of the water. My God, if you'd seen him. His eyes were all milky, and he was unresponsive. I noticed his legs from the knee down submerged in the water. When we pulled him out, I saw that the skin was rotting off the bone. I don't know how long he must have been sitting there for that to happen. In his hand was a burnt-out emergency flare, no doubt what he used to make the trail. His clothes were ragged, and he looked emaciated. We did a quick medical check, but since we only had basic supplies on hand, we couldn't do much for him. I told my team to haul him topside. I didn't like his odds of survival, and even if we could save his life, he'd never walk again. But I was relieved he wouldn't die alone down here. As my team started up the tunnel, I took a final glance at the pool. Just a cursory check, like I've done a million times before. That's when I locked eyes with an angel. Rick's scorch marks were used to map a reliable path to the flooded cavern, seemingly bypassing the unstable topology of the network. An examination of the pool revealed an evidence of life forms inhabiting the water. An aquatic mission confirmed the presence of at least one large marine organism, recently deceased and in good condition. Cause of death was determined to be starvation. The organism bore great visual similarities with the gray whale, with several major exceptions. Malformed eyes, sunken into the skull and covered with skin growth. A total lack of blowholes or breathing apparatus. Lack of baleen, though damage to the mouth suggests removal post-birth. Two arms, pale and bony, extending from either side of the torso and terminating in human-like hands. Due to its size, its removal from the cavern was deemed impossible, and all examinations had to be conducted by teams outfitted for sustained diving. The specimen's species has been named Gray Apostle at the behest of the head of research for 7900. In a memo to all personnel assigned to the anomaly, she writes, "It became immediately clear upon seeing the specimen myself that we are dealing with something far greater than what we started with. You have all been briefed on the history of this place. You have seen the devices used for torture, the murals and their macabre art. If you're like me, you've stood on the cliffs and stared into the sea as countless others have here throughout the millennia. What could they see that we can't? What could make them go smiling into a cold and lonely death? Your peers have no doubt spoken of mania and indoctrination. They've written everything that's happened here off as a sobering reminder of the dangers of cult thinking. We've been studying Notre Dame de la Mer for half a century. They'll tell you there's nothing left to find. They're wrong. What we found in the Devil's Well is more than an addendum to this page. It's the key to everything. The arms on either side of the whale aren't human-like. They are human. They are a near-perfect genetic match, size excepted. And we have reason to believe there's more. The cave continues past the limits of our floodlights. There's more down there. The testimony suggests live specimens, and I intend to find them. A small expeditionary force led by Dr. No was dispatched to explore the submerged portions of the cave network and to determine the presence of living organisms. When her unit failed to report their findings at the predetermined time, additional teams were arranged for rescue purposes. Believing the submerged tunnels possessed similar anomalous properties as the rest of the network, subsequent explorations would be conducted meticulously. Extensive terraforming efforts were made to ensure line of sight between team members would not be broken. This proved effective, as exploratory teams uncovered vast quantities of archaeological remains in sealed chambers within days. Recovered items resembled artifacts recovered above ground, but with a higher degree of technical skill. Almost all artworks solely depicted cetaceans. Skeletal remains in near-perfect condition were frequently encountered, many of which possessed human-like upper torsos fused to elongated lower spines ending in preserved flukes. Remains were frequently intermingled with larger cetacean skeletons, often congregating in the stomach region. On the fifth day of exploration, demolition crews uncovered an unusually large chamber resembling a fissure in the earth and extending down an indeterminate distance. While deliberating a course of action, crew members reported hearing whale song emanating from the bottom of the chasm. We're then given a testimony from the supervisor of the team, Lee DuPont, which reads, "I'm looking down there, and I'm telling myself, don't go down. Don't go down. There's nothing down there. Not my mission, not my problem, right? I mean, when has something good ever happened when you poke around where you're not wanted? But that's the thing, isn't it? I was wanted. They wanted me down there. That's what you guys keep getting wrong. This isn't another death cult. It's not another Alagada. It's our ticket out of here. It's a way off of this whole messed up world we're in. They didn't kill No and her team. You want to know how I know that? Because they told me. They have a way of doing that. Communicating something to you in an instant. It's hard to articulate, but after it happens, you just know what they wanted you to know. Like waking up from a dream. I took one look down there. It was over in an instant. My team protested to going down there, but then they saw it too. They heard the siren's call. We start out afraid of the dark, but then we grow up. We peel the curtain back and find out there was nothing to be scared of in the first place. We evolve, and my evolution was in that cave. I don't remember everything I saw down there. It was like a dream. I can't recall the details, but I'll never forget the faces. Horrible, mummified, scared. Millions of them starving to death in that pit. Nothing to eat after the apostles died and the drowning stopped. I see the faces of the devotees, given new life and new blood from the water. I saw No in the bliss of her newfound immortality. I saw my team screaming as they accepted God's blessing. I saw Rick and Tanner and Urchek. I saw myself from a distance. But most vividly of all, I saw God. My God, watching from above through the cracks in the rock. A whale's eye, blue as sapphire. And I let his song cleanse and birth me new. He has hopes for us, inheritors of his deluge. It's been so long since he's seen the surface. I can't wait." Lee DuPont was found by rescue personnel hours later, while the other six team members had been declared MIA. DuPont's skeletal structure began transformation the following morning, and he has been placed in a pressurized aquatic environment to reduce pain and to observe the extent of bodily and mental changes. The Department of Cetacean Studies has been formed to document this and other related phenomena. Recent expeditions have discovered the underwater fissure via demolition efforts, but investigations within the chamber found no signs of the humanoids nor the massive cetaceans described by DuPont. Impressions in the rock imply the presence of a great number of organisms, but none were present. Concurrently, motion sensors at 400, 317, and 199 meters were tripped by unknown forces. Widespread technical malfunctions were ruled out, and on-site security declared an Ecke-class emergency. Security Chief Sebastian Banks ordered the entrance to the subterranean network to be caved in with a controlled blast, sealing the system and averting a potential containment breach. During his debrief, Banks recounted the following. You want to know about the cave-in? That's what this is all about, right? You want to know why I ordered my men to bury the last 6 months of my job in 3,000 tons of solid rock? Something tripped the sensors. And fast, too. Too fast to be a single entity. Hell, too fast to be a group, either. Those tunnels are narrow. There's no way anybody could climb 200 meters in less than a minute. Unless it's water. It has to be. It's a flood, coming up from the abyss. The deluge, right? That's what DuPont called it? Yeah, I listened to the tape. He was messed up in the head, but maybe he was onto something. We found something terrible, and awesome, and beautiful down there. We fight it now because we're scared. But give it some time. Maybe we hit the jackpot. Who knows where we'll be in 10, 20 years. Whatever. It's over now. That cave's airtight. Nothing's getting out in 1,000 years. But all we've got is time. And water's patient. So, underneath the monastery is some sort of whale deity that draws people down into the subterranean depths in order to transform them into immortal whale hybrids. They've sealed the underground tunnels for now, but it's either a part of the water or has control over it, and it will eventually erode enough stone to get out. On the one hand, I'm not sure if I'd like being an immortal whale, but folks that have jumped on board seem pretty into it, so maybe there is something to it. Let's finish with SCP-5003, a large piece of complex machinery located 250 meters beneath sublevel 39 of Site-19, capable of generating energy from an unknown source. It consists of three different components: a main power housing, a central control hub, and a vast tunnel system expanding from the control center. The central control hub lies within a cavern located approximately 36 kilometers from the entrance, with walls lined with wires and cables from the main power housing. Additionally, the cavern contains a control panel, chairs, a whiteboard, fluorescent lights, and four large scorch marks across the eastern and northern walls. The main power housing is presumed to be located in a chamber adjacent to the central control hub, since all cables in 5003 have been traced back to that area. Initial attempts to locate an entrance to this chamber have failed. Therefore, there is no conclusive evidence that this is the power source for 5003. The tunnel system is largely unexplored, with initial reconnaissance discovering that they are lit by fluorescent lights and lined with cables that are connected to the main power housing. The only known entrance to 5003 is through a metal door located in the service tunnels on sublevel 39 of Site-19. Inspection of the Site-19 blueprints indicated that these tunnels were never originally meant to be part of the site's construction. On June 21st, 2014, Site-19 sensors picked up a spike in electromagnetic activity underneath the site. Searches of the lower levels of the site located the doorway to 5003, which was open at the time of discovery. Afterwards, Dr. Raven Coulette proposed a series of experiments to be run on the machinery to determine the functionality of the control panel, and if the anomaly requires additional containment protocols. These experiments were to be carried out by a team consisting of researcher Thomas DeWalt and D-Class 3481. Since the travel time from the entrance to the control center is approximately 7 hours, DeWalt and the D-Class were equipped with 3 days' worth of water and rations, sleeping bags, flashlights, and a standard-issue Foundation fieldwork radio. Testing was scheduled to take place over the course of 2 days. On the first day, Thomas and the D-Class Charles start by flipping a switch on the machine. The humming sound from the machinery stops. A scream is heard, followed by a repeated crackling noise. After a few moments, the humming returns, and Charles gets on the radio. He's breathing erratically and says that he flipped the switch and some lightning came out of the control panel, hitting Thomas. Now he isn't moving, although he thinks he's alive as he's looking at him. Coulette deploys a medical team, and Charles says that also the lights in one of the tunnels went out. Coulette tells him that he needs to calm down, as it'll be about 8 hours to get to them. An hour later, Coulette tells him, however, that the medical team has reached the entrance to the tunnels, but the door is shut. They're trying to figure out how to open it safely, as they can't just blow it up due to being underneath Site-19. She assures him that they'll get them out, but she doesn't know how long. In the meantime, he needs to get the binder of testing information from Thomas's pack so he can continue testing. We see some supplemental documentation for the article that's all been classified, including a schematics overview of sublevel 39, re-entry attempts to 5003, and the minutes of an ethics committee meeting about 5003. The following day, she contacts him again, but he says that he hasn't started testing yet. Thomas and him ate, but Charles couldn't really sleep last night, as he couldn't stop thinking about the tunnel where the lights went out. Coulette tells him that they still haven't gotten the door open, causing him to swear and cry that he doesn't want to die down here. She manages to calm him down by asking where he's from, and reassuring him that they'll get him out of there, before telling him to get started on those tests. Some more supplemental documentation includes subterranean scans of Site-19, and an exploration log of sublevel 39. On day 3, Charles says that they have probably enough rations for another day, which she tells him that they'll possibly get him out in a day or two. Charles hopes that it's not much longer, as he thinks Thomas is starting to panic. He's just been looking down the tunnel with no lights. He's moved him to the other side of the room, but he doesn't think it helped. Charles continues doing the testing on the power readings, and we can see that there's been another ethics committee meeting about 5003. On the fourth day, he tells Coulette that he found more food. He felt something like a cold breeze coming from the tunnel where the lights went out. He went down that way and found berry bushes growing out of the walls, despite this being the same tunnel that the two came down originally. He says they look normal, and Coulette just says that more food is a good thing. I suspect that if this were anyone other than a D-Class, that would not be the standard Foundation protocol. She asks about Thomas, and he says that he's fine, but still paralyzed. Some more classified documentation about electromagnetic wave analysis for 5003 and reclamation attempts on sublevel 39. That can't be good. On the fifth day, she asks about his test results and asks if he's sure he's following the directions in the binder. According to his last batch of results, the power output of the source hasn't changed much since the first day. He's positive about them, though, as he even double-checked the connections between the multimeter and power lines 5G and 11D this morning. She says that if he's sure he's following the directions, she may have to try running the numbers on her end again. There's some more supplemental documentation on recovered flora from sublevel 39, and the compromise of sublevels 36 through 38. On the sixth day, Charles contacts Coulette to tell her about how there's bats filling up the entire dark tunnel. They're flying around the entrance, but haven't entered the control room. She asks him if he's certain that they're bats, but he can't really tell. He then says that they've stopped, and they're all on the ground now looking at him. He's certain they're bats now, so Colette tells him to hit the button on the control panel labeled emergency after he finishes today's round of testing. He doesn't remember an emergency button being mentioned in the binder, and she tells him that they weren't planning on testing it. He, of course, asks what it does, but she just says that it's difficult to explain. It's classified. There's some more documentation on 5003 testing operation evaluation and the deployment of MTF Beta 7, a group that specializes in the containment of anomalies exhibiting extreme biological, chemical, or radiological hazards. On the seventh day, Colette asks about Thomas, and Charles says that he's calmed down some, as his gaze looks more relaxed. She then asks how much water he has left, and Charles says not much, as they effectively ran out yesterday. She asks if he wants her to tell him how much water they sent him with, to which he just says no. She swears, and Charles says that it's not like Thomas would have made it anyways. She asks if he even tried to feed him, and he just says that they were supposed to be down here 2 days ago. Colette pauses before saying that there's been complications. He calls her out on that, to which she says that what will get them down there is him finishing his testing and hitting that button. She says that it's not that much to ask, but he replies that that's easy for her to say. She then tells him that they're leaving him down there until he hits that button. He replies by asking if they were ever coming for him, but he gets no response. There's some more supplemental documentation about the Anomaly Mobilization Directive and Operation SCP-5003 Red Evaluation. On the eighth day, Charles tries to contact her, but gets no response. He says that he's been trying to keep himself awake because he's been feeling more and more tired. He's worried that the next time he goes to sleep, he won't wake up. It's just him, a corpse, and the power source. He's been thinking about that emergency button. He knows she wants him to hit it, but it's probably just an emergency off switch that turns off the power source, and the heat, and the lights. He doesn't know why she wants this thing turned off. Maybe there's something happening up there, but it's probably classified anyways. He laughs to himself and says that he's taking deep breaths, like she told him. They got him through a lot down here. He was looking forward to getting out, and says that it was pretty cruel to give him hope for so long. He thought he was going to see the sky again. He thinks he's going to leave it on, because at the end of the day, he's just a scared man. He's afraid of the tunnels, the bats, and the control panel. He's afraid of the dark, and doesn't know what would happen to him in the blackness. So he's going to leave the lights on. There's one last bit of supplemental documentation, at only level 2 classified now, detailing the evacuation of Site-19. So, a researcher and a D-class head down into a weird sub-basement of Site-19 in order to run some tests on this weird machinery. Once they flick the first switch, though, the researcher gets blasted, the door gets shut, and the tunnel they came from goes dark. The D-class eventually lets the researcher die because he wants to survive for longer, but he's also scared of the dark coming from the tunnel. He's an obedient D-class, though, so he helps run through the tests, which only serve to confuse the higher-ups with the results. Meanwhile, they can't get the door to the tunnels open, and things start spilling out into the sub-basement itself. We have no idea what those things are, but they're pretty bad, as they take over the whole sub-level, along with a few more sub-levels. Colette tries to get the D-class to hit the big emergency button, but he's too worried about it shutting off the lights and leaving him in the dark, so he refuses. In the end, Site-19 is completely evacuated. Presumably there's an end-of-the-world situation going on, and the D-Class is left alone to die with the lights on. Granted, it does seem a bit absurd that Coulette or anyone else working up there wouldn't be a bit more clear and adamant that he hit that button, considering what was at stake. Apparently, however, Thomas was the one that was trained and experienced at handling D-Class, while Coulette was out of her depth, also panicking and swearing. At the same time, even if they had told the D-Class that hitting that button would save everyone upstairs, I'm still not sure he would do it, as it was highly unlikely he would have lived long enough to be rescued regardless. I'm sure some people would hit that button and die in the dark so others can live in the light, but as a D-Class, it's not like he owes the Foundation a whole lot. Being underground and in the dark is naturally scary, which is partly why subterranean SCPs can work pretty well. Much like the depths of the ocean or the vast reaches of outer space, there's a lot of potential for the unknown underground. From endless tunnels, to ancient gods, to anomalies that warp time and space, it's all tucked away, waiting for some unfortunate soul to stumble across it. Maybe it then gets brought into the light at that point, but more likely, it gets buried once again, waiting eons under the earth, until it's uncovered once more.